The 115th Congress took office as Donald Trump became president. It is the most racially diverse Congress in American history. But how diverse is that? One in five of our senators and representatives is a member of a racial or ethnic minority, and about one in five is a woman. More than in the past, but does not line up with the country where we live in, where almost 40% are minorities and more than half are women. And of course, one of our 45 presidents has been black. Women, still waiting. You might think that elected officials would reflect the population in large, multiracial, multi-ethnic cities like New York and San Francisco, but the story in urban America is a bit surprising. Journalist Russell Berman examines urban political representation in a recent Atlantic Magazine article titled "The White Men's Club Leading America's Largest City." Welcome, Russell.
Good to be with you.
And Fordham University political scientist Dr. Christina Greer is conducting research on a history of all African Americans who have run for executive office in the United States. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you.
All right, let's do a big picture question and then we'll drill down. Start with you, Russell. How many large cities have mayors who are women or people of color?
Of the top 15, there is one African-American male and no women. And 12 of the 15 mayors are white men. We have two male mayors who have a mixed heritage. Eric Garcetti is part Mexican in Los Angeles. And Ron Nuremberg in San Antonio, his mother is Malaysian.
How has this changed from recent years?
You know, it actually used to be more diverse. In cities like Philadelphia and Detroit, a few years ago, you would see African-American mayors. There was a woman mayor of Houston before Sylvester Turner took over. He's the one African-American mayor of the top 15. So it's actually been a bit of a regression, and it's obviously a small sample size, so we can't necessarily say it's a trend. But it is, interesting to see. And, as you said, we think of our cities as our sort of bastions of diversity, of progressive politics. They're overwhelmingly Democratic, and yet that diversity is just not represented in City Hall.
And when there are no black governors, which I find amazing in the United States. Stacey Abrams might change that.
Right,
she might.
We've had a history of two elected black male governors in the history of the United States and zero black female governors ever in the history of the United States. So Stacey Abrams in Georgia could be the very first.
Yeah, it was Doug Wilder and Deval Patrick, right?
Yes.
And then Pinchback was the third sort of half.
Yeah.
Half mayor back in the day.
Reconstruction.
Christina, the current makeup of city government, is it a trend? Is it a political moment?
I think we need to be concerned about where we're going, especially if we look at how cities are changing. I mean, we know that, there's been some great reporting about, say, black and Latino men being locked up and black women specifically being locked out, meaning higher rates of eviction, higher rates of mobility, higher rates being pushed out of cities. So, I mean, if we even look at a city like New York, where we have this idea of affordable housing, but it's based on an index that adds in Westchester County and, all these counties that are not New York City, where, we say a middle-income family is making $60,000, that's not the reality for a lot of New Yorkers, especially a lot of New Yorkers of color. So you add sort of this exodus, a non-voluntary exodus out of cities. You add sort of certain cities that are tearing down public housing and where those people are supposed to go. You know, in Baltimore, Hopkins is about to clear out several, blocks and just destroy public housing. And so that's happening in a lot of cities. And so that forces people, besides incarceration, high rents, and then the lack of public housing, is a perfect storm where you're creating these cities where they can't just be cities for wealthy individuals or individuals who make above the index of what it means to be middle class.
Russell, you pointed to San Francisco as an example. There was a controversy following the sudden death of Mayor Ed Lee. I was actually in San Francisco the day he died, and I turned my hotel room and I turned on. The city was really reeling that day.
It was very sudden.
Yeah, and I turned on the TV and I was surprised. I didn't know about London Breed. I didn't really understand the secession plan. So London Breed is an African American woman. Can you explain to people how she became acting mayor and then what happened after that?
Sure. So she was the president of the Board of Supervisors, which is San Francisco's city council for people in New York. And under the San Francisco law, she became acting mayor as soon as there was a vacancy, so as soon as he died, pending the special election that is going to be held in June. And so just like 40 years ago, Dianne Feinstein who was the president of the Board of Supervisors when George Moscone and Harvey Milk were assassinated. Diane Feinstein became the acting mayor. She ran for the job. She was elected. She served for 10 years. That was what London Breed was hoping to do. But the Board of Supervisors, the people who had elected her president twice, they 6 weeks after she became acting mayor, they held a long board meeting and it replaced her with a white man, Mark Farrell. And, you know, there were internal politics involved. There was another member of the board, Jane Kim, who is running, so they didn't think that London Breed should get sort of an unfair advantage of incumbency going into the election. But, of course, her supporters, in part because of what was said at this meeting and because, you know, some insinuations that were made about her ties to a hedge funder, to a venture capitalist out in Silicon Valley, you know, they said, and it was racism, you know, and that, you know, Amos Brown, the pastor of the Third Baptist Church out in San Francisco, told me, you know, this is connected to San Francisco's long history of racism. It, you know, he calls it a, quote, liberal, very progressive city. But, you know, in fact, again, that's not reflected in its leadership and that's not always reflected in its policies.
We have Reverend Brown, who's also, I think he's the president of the NAACP chapter in San Francisco there. He said the city mirrors what he calls America's original sin of race. How do you feel about that characterization, Christina?
I think it's accurate. I mean, we can look back and think about Marion Barry, the first black mayor who's elected to Washington, D.C., and all of a sudden you have the federal government quick, fast, in a hurry, changing policies to make sure that they strip him for basically like 70% of his powers. So this isn't new. Mm-hmm. And we know that, you know, oftentimes when it comes to people of color or women possibly becoming in positions of power, everyone wants to become a socialist and all of a sudden say, well, that's not fair. So maybe we should just rearrange the rules that have been on the books mm-hmm. that have always worked for everyone else. But now that, you know, you might become in a position of power, we need to rethink these rules all of a sudden. And so I think that that's just a certain level of institutional racism mm-hmm. that has existed and continues to exist that disproportionately affects people of color. And it also affects female candidates across the country as well.
We're talking to Professor Christina Greer and Russell Berman of The Atlantic. We're talking about the White Men's Club leading America's largest cities. That was the article that Russell wrote that we sort of is the springboard for this conversation. Russell, about London Breed, which I find interesting, I'd like to know more about it, is the hardcore progressives didn't like her because she had a wealthy hedge fund backer? You mentioned that.
Yeah, venture capitalist. And it's the broader argument is that she, you know, in San Francisco, the politics are left and further left. You know, that's sometimes how it's described. And so she is just left or more moderate, business friendly. And Jane Kim has aligned herself with Bernie Sanders. So she has support among the really, you know, hardcore progressives, I guess. And so that's sort of the backstory of the politics in San Francisco. But, you know, we see that, and Dr. Groot, you know, talked to me about that as well. We see that in other cities where sometimes the African-American candidate, you know, is seen as aligned with sort of the white business community. And that's where they're trying to build their coalition to win. And then it sort of turns them off among the more, you know, progressive community. And so then it allows like a white candidate to sort of cut into their base. And, you know, we saw that a little bit in New York City in 2013 with Bill de Blasio and Bill Thompson, who was seen, Bill Thompson was the African-American candidate and was seen as the more sort of moderate, less progressive candidate.
And Christine Quinn.
And Christine Quinn, of course.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if we remember Willie Brown, when he was running, you know, he said, I want to be the buildingest mayor in the history of all mayors, right?
San Francisco.
In San Francisco. And so, you know, when we see a lot of black candidates, their way, because the black power base in so many cities in so many ways is completely attached to the white power base as well. And so in order to be successful, you have to understand and become allied with, to a certain extent, a white power base financially. And we've seen this across the country with different candidates. Because of that, you know, I was telling Russell when we talked for the story, when Kurt Schmoke became the first black mayor in Baltimore, mm-hmm. the running joke was, you know, when Baltimore got its first Irish mayor, he made the largest number of Irish millionaires. And then when they got their first Italian mayor, Nancy Pelosi's dad, mm-hmm. they got the largest number of Italian millionaires. And then when they had their first Jewish mayor, they had the largest number of Jewish millionaires. And then they got Kurt Schmoke, the black mayor. And when Kurt Schmoke became mayor of Baltimore as the first black mayor, Baltimore got their largest number of Irish, Italian, and Jewish millionaires. And so, you know, unfortunately, that is the way a lot of people feel about black mayors, where does the money go? There's, you want to build, you want to develop, you want to redesign a city, but where does that leave, in many ways, black and Latino communities once that's happened? We also have to look at the context in which black mayors first get elected. Oftentimes, these are cities that didn't just suffer white flight, they suffered middle-class flight. So part of their agenda was to actually either lure people back to a city or to make sure people didn't leave the city. And so, and to really keep that tax base steady, mm-hmm. or to rebuild it, full stop. And so that's where this relationship with the build, with the business community comes in, that can make it really tense because you're building, but like,
yeah.
how do you then support the people who feel like, well, mm-hmm. I was here when the city was down, right? When we had nothing, when no one really cared about us, when cities were proclaimed dead, and now you're building, but for whom, and then what happens to me now that we have all these great things? You know, there's a Whole Foods, but will I ever be able to live in my neighborhood again to actually even enjoy it?
Yeah. In terms of your reporting, when we talk about city councils and boards and this, does it vary from city to city, the power dynamic between mayors and city councils, and how does that, what's the impact of that on this discussion?
That's very interesting. It does. I mean, I don't know every city, but they vary. Some cities, the mayor is more powerful. Some, they really have to depend on the city council. So, you know, let's take New York as an example. The mayor in different periods of time has been in sort of conflict and confrontation with the city council. Then you see the city council speaker become a confrontational candidate, either against the incumbent mayor or to succeed the incumbent mayor. And so in 2013, Christine Quinn was running as the speaker of the city council. She had a more collaborative approach with Mayor Bloomberg than her predecessors with Rudy Giuliani, for example. And that became a problem for her, principally because she supported the extension of term limits that allowed Bloomberg to win a third term. And so that really, you know, ultimately did her in, you know, or was one of the mm-hmm. things that did her in 2013, where she started as this front runner in a similar way, incidentally, that Hillary Clinton did as, you know, a presidential candidate in 2016. But ultimately, by the end of the race, she was in a distant third.
Based on your research, Dr. Greer, or Christina, which do you prefer?
Christina.
Okay, good. Based on your research, Christina, and based on what we observe with Christine Quinn, what is the scenario with someone like London Breed? What is she going to have to do to possibly win, given this sort of difficult situation she's in where she's got her money base that the progressives aren't that thrilled about?
Right. Well, I think it's funny that all of a sudden money is the problem, right? we've never really had that conversation. But I think, you know, when you look at candidates of color, they have to win with coalitions because there's never a majority of, you know, in her case, mm-hmm. there's not a majority of black people in San Francisco that are going to hand her the race. So what kinds of coalitions does she put together? I mean, if her opponent is saying, well, I'm the progressive, does she go after essentially a white business community, but that messaging could put her at odds with, say, black voters as well. She really does also need to think about who comes out in a primary, right? I mean, if the main attraction is the primary and not the general mm-hmm. election, who's actually participating in a primary will possibly dictate who her coalitions need to be, full stop. And, you know, I'm always amazed at the number of politicians who ignore the Asian American community. Like, we all know, listen, like, black women are the backbone of the Democratic Party and democracy writ large right mm-hmm. now. We get it and have been for quite some time. But when I look at polling, the polling usually talks about blacks, whites, and Latinos, depending on where you are. But in so many places, California, especially New York, parts of Texas and
New
even
Jersey,
the South,
too,
you know,
East Asian, yeah.
a lot of places, all politics is local. Thank you, Tip mm-hmm. O'Neill. Right. So especially in a place like San Francisco, you know, what does the diversity within the Asian American community look like, especially in a primary? And, you know, for people who want to be successful, you know, sometimes you have to go back to the well of the sort of diehard voters who always turn out in a primary. But then when you look at someone like Obama, or if you're an insurgent candidate, and if she runs as, say, an insurgent candidate, that means you have to mobilize and motivate new people to come into the fold. And for so many Asian American voters, no one's ever bother to come to their community to ask, right? I mean, we've seen, depending on where you live, there are Asian Americans who are hardcore Democrats, and some are quite Republican, depending, and that crosses generation, it crosses class. So she might have to actually extend what the definition of coalition means, and not just going for LGBT, Black, Latino business communities, but also Asian Americans too.
And that's especially true in San Francisco because one of her main opponents is an Asian American woman who would be making history herself. And so that's going to be, you know, very important. And I also talk in the piece a little bit about, because you mentioned that so many of these races are determined by primaries. And the primary electorate, even in cities that are majority Black, are often, you see lower turnout among African Americans and higher turnout among whites. In a city like New York, we've talked about, has very restrictive voting laws, similar to, in some cases, states in the South, not with IDs necessarily, but no early voting, no easy registration. And so that depresses turnout more often among minority communities. And so that's a factor in this as well.
All right. We're going to talk a little more about voter turnout. We're going to check out a couple of other cities, figure out what they've got going on there. I'm Allison Stewart, and I'm speaking with Dr. Christina Greer, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University, and Russell Berman, staff writer from The Atlantic, about the drop in diversity in public offices, in public officials in big cities. Later on the show, Bethany Hamilton, the famous surfer who lost an arm in a shark attack, along with her husband Adam Dirks and filmmaker Aaron Lieber, about their new documentary. Plus, Man Booker Prize winning author Julian Barnes joins us to discuss his novel, The Only Story. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after the break. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and I am back with Dr. Christina Greer, and Russell Berman, a writer for The Atlantic. We're talking about the lack of diversity, the upper levels of local office in cities we think about as being incredibly diverse, and we're exploring why. During the break, we were chatting a little bit about even our definitions of what big, diverse cities are. It's a little skewed, right? You would think New Orleans would be in that list, or Detroit, but they're not, right?
Right, and there's a couple of different reasons. One is the drop in population in some of these cities, especially Detroit, for example, and New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And then there's cities define their boundaries in different ways. So you take Atlanta as an example, which has an African-American woman as a mayor. The city itself is not in the top 15, although Atlanta as an urban area is, I think, the eighth largest in the country. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with Washington, D.C. It's in the top 25, but not the top 15, and they've had a succession of African-American mayors. Most recently, of course, the current mayor, Muriel Bowser. But as an urban area, it's much larger than it is as a city. So that's an important distinction to make.
Mm-hmm. Christina, what do you think about, in the South, there seem to be a bunch of young African-American mayors in cities that we associate with difficulty in the civil rights movement. Birmingham just elected this young 36-year-old fellow named Randall Woodfin, Morehouse graduate, came back home, decided he wanted to fix his city. What do you think about that, these secondary cities where people are leaving home and coming back, people of color?
Well, I think we're also seeing a generational divide. I mean, part of his argument was, I'm going against someone who was mayor when I was born, right? And I think at a certain point, when we look at these younger candidates who are having success, Lumumba in, I believe, Mississippi, they're making the argument of our predecessors have done a great job and they've laid a foundation and they beat the odds. Some of them were the first. Mm-hmm. But, in cities that don't have term limits, where someone can become essentially a dynasty.
Mayor for life, yeah.
Yeah, and it's at what point does it stop serving the community? And so you're seeing people who can say, I went to public school here. I love this place. It is my home. I did leave to go and explore the world, to explore other parts of the country. I've learned some things, and now I want to come back and contribute to my community. That is a very powerful argument that is resonating with a lot of people just because they are looking up and saying, we saw this in Harlem on a congressional level, but, Charlie Rangel was elected. He was in office for 46 years. He did some great things for Harlem. But at a certain point in time, some people felt like after 46 years, maybe we need to think about diversity of leadership because the community has changed and some of the needs and wants are quite different.
Let's talk a little bit about, I want to talk about Rahm Emanuel and Bill de Blasio in a minute, but something you just said, diversity of community, diversity of thought. We're not having this conversation, and people aren't thinking about this just because they want to check boxes and have, we have a black mayor, we have a woman mayor. Can you both discuss a little bit about what kind of policies would be affected, could be affected in the best way by having diversity at these levels?
Well, you know, London Breed talks about her experience more than her identity as being sort of central to her candidacy and sort of as a diverse representation in her campaign for San Francisco. She grew up in poverty, was raised by her grandmother. You know, she says, I don't think there's ever been a member of the Board of Supervisors of San Francisco that's grown up in poverty in San Francisco. And so she brought that experience to bear. And she, you know, gave me a story about her talking about the issue of incarceration. And there was a proposal to build a new jail in the city. And so she talked about her brother who has been in jail and is incarcerated currently and has been for much of his adult life, and that was an experience that was unique. And so it wasn't just about that she is a black woman. It was about the way in which, you know, she was raised. And you know, we heard a lot about that as well. Remember when Sonia Sotomayor was nominated for the Supreme Court, and that was a big sort of debate. Should her experiences be sort of part of the reason for confirming her? Is that an important part of diversity on the Supreme Court? Now, obviously, President Obama and the Democrats argued that it was, and Republicans said that's just playing identity politics and that should not be, it should only be the law, and it has nothing to do with it.
Side note, Anton Scalia said the same thing about his Italian heritage, and no one bothered to say that. But I agree with Russell. You know, I think when we're looking at budgets, right, and granted, we know that mayors' budgets are oftentimes constrained by the larger state budgets, but budgets are a moral document. And so, you know, especially when it comes to female candidates and female candidates of color, you know, unfortunately, we still have this idea of certain things are women's issues, right? All issues are women's issues. But if we're thinking about education or how we should look at childcare or how we should look at incarceration, these are issues that, you know, candidates of color and women tend to raise at higher rates than white candidates. But we can even look at someone like de Blasio, who chose to use his family as a vehicle to talk about certain issues. Bill Thompson chose not to, right? Mm-hmm. They both have sons, black sons. Mm-hmm. And de Blasio talked about stop and frisk, which in 2013 was one of the biggest issues on primary voters' minds. So he said, you know, as a parent of a black son, right? Sometimes he said it explicitly, sometimes he said it implicitly. But I will be someone that works with the NYPD to really change some of the systemic oppression that we've seen over the years, institutionalized racism, the list goes on and on. And I think that resonated with a lot of voters of color in a primary. Bill Thompson, as we know, chose not to address that head on and ultimately didn't resonate with black voters at the same rates as Bill de Blasio did. So I think, you know, sometimes it's issue specific depending on the time and the geographic locale. But I do think that oftentimes candidates of color tend to take on issues that should be talked about more by all mayors, but they use them as issues to really try and galvanize people to think about how their local politics affects their lives directly.
It's interesting that you should bring up de Blasio because he's sort of an interesting case because he is in this family, this mixed family part of it. He's obviously part of it. But the NYPD didn't necessarily react well to what he said.
No, they turned their backs on him, as
right.
I recall.
I mean, let's be real. About
there's
that.
Also a reputation of Democratic mayors not getting along with police departments, right? Police departments across the country have historically said that, you know, Democratic mayors are soft on crime. Mm-hmm. We know that black Democratic mayors have always had usually a tense relationship with police officers. Part of that has to do with old school ethnic politics. Part of that has to do with just downright racism. Part of that has to do with misunderstandings, right? Or assumptions that Democrats will either defund certain things or, you know, sort of try and push towards agendas that would make the lives of police officers harder. Obviously, in 2013, the big issue was if we end stop and frisk, the city will turn into mayhem. Everyone will get their chains stolen and, you know, it'll just be pandemonium. We obviously can see that we can actually decrease the hypercriminalization of black and brown people, men and women and youth, and actually have a pretty safe city, actually the safest city in the country. So there is a disconnect between Democratic mayors and police departments in many ways. I always wondered whether or not Bill de Blasio would be treated like many black mayors have been treated because his rhetoric mirrored the rhetoric of a lot of black mayors across the country.
Well, what do you think?
When it comes to the NYPD, I think so. I think, you know, maybe not as egregiously as David Dinkins was treated, but I definitely think that it falls within the vein of the tension between a Democratic mayor and a police department.
Something I want to dive down with you, Christine, is in your book, Black Ethnics, you examine the tension between racial identity and cultural ethnic distinction. And I'm not sure a lot of people think about it that way. Mm-hmm. Could you lay out for us what that thesis is and way you see it relating to this topic?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I look at Afro-Caribbeans, Africans, and Black Americans, and sort of what does 21st century Black politics look like? You know, we no longer have this monolith. Well, we never really had a monolith, but we no longer have this idea of a monolith of sort of Black politics where everyone's the descendant of the U.S. South and descendant of U.S. chattel slavery, and not everyone's Baptist, right? There's geographic diversity, there's ethnic diversity, there's class diversity, and what people want from their candidates. So, you know, if we take a city like New York or Chicago or Atlanta or Houston or Miami, LA, when you look at the Black population, there's a growing number of people who are either first generation or second generation or Black undocumenteds, right? Right now, Black undocumenteds make up 10% of the undocumented population, but 20% of the deportations. So we know that Black families are also living in mixed status households. Mm-hmm. We know that because of geographic segregation, Black immigrants tend to live in Black American communities at higher rates. So that does create really fascinating and sometimes tenuous conversations about who our elected leaders should be, right? There are so many Caribbean communities that are now second and third generation where they're saying, well, okay, it's not enough just to have a Black representative. Like, I want actually a Caribbean representative. And even to drill down even deeper, you know, we're looking at Brooklyn and some of the tensions there. It's like, well, there's on the books, you know, an idea to have a little Haiti. And then it changed to sort of be a conversation about, oh, well, let's make it a little Caribbean. It's like, no. Actually, we have enough people here and enough history here where it actually should be a little Haiti specifically, right? And so now you see other Caribbean groups saying, no, I want my specific Caribbean identity to be represented. So these are great
conversations, but
when it comes to, say, mayors, right, mayors have to recognize that if they're going to target, say, a Black community, especially like think about someplace like Miami, right? You can't just talk about a quote-unquote Black American issue. Mm-hmm. It has to be an issue that addresses immigration, right? Documented or undocumented.
I mean, it's similar in certain respects to, you mentioned Miami. I mean, a lot of people like to talk about the Latino community, but the Latino community is, of course, very diverse. Mm-hmm. And the political views of Cuban Americans compared to Latinos from pretty much any other country are very different. You have Cuban Americans who have historically been Republican in South Florida.
Right.
It's changing a little bit. But then the Latino population from other countries is much more Democratic. And you know, to your point, you know, we're seeing that in city council races in New York City as well with the Afro-Caribbean community and the African-American, you know, like what you might more traditionally define as African-American, it's very interesting.
I'm speaking with Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University, Dr. Christina Greer, and Russell Berman, staff writer at The Atlantic. This conversation was sparked by Russell's article, The White Man's Club Leading America's Largest Cities. I do want to talk a little bit about voter turnout in our last few minutes. Mark Mariel, the former mayor of New Orleans, says there's been a decline in enthusiasm among African-American voters in local elections. Do you think this is true? Is this true? And
well, we're seeing declining turnout overall in local elections, which is a big problem. It's been a big problem for the Democratic Party over the last few years. And then within that is even more of a decline in turnout among African Americans and other minority groups. And, you know, so as I mentioned, you know, in some cities like New York, you can look directly at the things like the voting laws and the lack of early voting and the lack of, you know, automatic registration, which has been implemented in certain other states. And you can look at issues, you know, around people are constantly moving in a city like New York, and so they're not, you don't develop that habit of voting in the same place, and it's, you know, it can get very specific, but you would see, like so many other issues, that it impacts minority communities more than it does white communities who may, you know, not move as much.
Yeah, I mean, when we look at the trends, I mean, with, say, like Dinkins and Giuliani in 89 and 93, I mean, the rates of participation were exponentially higher than, say, 2013. I think also, you know, we have to be a lot more specific about issues. We need to be a lot better about candidate selection to really galvanize people and actually go to communities that may not have necessarily turned out. I think people tend to go back to the same reliable well. And I think a lot of candidates are actually quite happy that turnout is pretty low, because that pretty much guarantees them, especially those who don't have term limits for certain legislative races, you know who's going to turn out for you, and you actually don't want everyone turning out because that can complicate your primary, because in so many places, the primary is the election.
Right.
Oftentimes in the general, you don't even have a Republican opponent. So there's the issues piece, but also, when it comes to New York specifically, we ask a lot of our electorate. Now, as a Black woman, I vote, as they say in Chicago, early and often, right? I try, just because of the history of the Civil Rights Movement and the Voting Rights Act, if there's a primary, I'm in it. If there's a runoff, I'm in it. Like, I go to the polls every time I'm asked to go to the polls. Mm-hmm. We have now, depending on where you live in New York, you're going to go to the polls on Tuesday, next Tuesday, April 24th. You're then going to go to the polls in June to vote for your congressional, in your congressional primary. Then you're going to go to the polls in September to vote for your gubernatorial primary and your Albany representatives. And then you're going to go to the polls in November to vote in the general. And so keep in mind, we just asked voters to vote four times last year because it was a presidential year. So we're constantly asking.
Voter fatigue.
Yeah, I mean, we had the presidential elections four times in 2016. Mm-hmm. In 2017, we had our municipal elections and city council races and, our sort of big comptroller public advocate races. And now, again, three to four times in 2018. And then we have a short reprieve and just special elections for miscellaneous things in 2019. But then we go
here comes
back
2020.
Again, 2020 again. And so I don't necessarily know. For some people, it is apathy. For other people, it's fatigue. And for others, it's just misinformation and not having the knowledge to know that you're actually supposed to turn out. And, there are huge information gaps in New York City where a lot of people, whenever I wear my I voted sticker, they're like, voted for what? Wait, are you voting today? I mean, so there's certain information that's not being disseminated to certain communities that today, or this is a Tuesday, you should be voting. And of course, in New York, we're voting September 13th, which is a Thursday, because of September 11th falling on a Tuesday, which is going to further confuse some people.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. And keep in mind, it's like kids are right back at school, and so other people are trying to wrap some things up.
It always surprises me when I learned that voter turnout in New York is down 15%. I mean, I think of New Yorkers as being incredibly active, engaged people in their civic life. Is there anything that can be done or is being done to extend the opportunity for people to vote, electronic voting?
Well, in New York, there's been a big debate about early voting, and that's on a state level. And so we can get into the gubernatorial primary. But there's been a lot of talk about things like automatic voting registration in New York, early voting. It's been behind the times, and we'll see. There is some momentum. It's possible that we could get some reforms, depending on the outcome of the elections this year, in the next couple of years in New York.
Have these kind of reforms been shown to have an impact in underrepresented communities and minority communities?
Right. Well, I know NYC Votes is really pushing a lot of just what Russell said, thinking about how we can make registration easier, how we can really target seniors in high school in a much more robust way, how we can sort of get, in North Carolina, North Carolina had better, their state government's trying to roll things back, but, souls to the polls. And so, of course, the Republican legislature is saying that's partisan and it's racialized, but, really helping to galvanize communities, not just the 1 week before voting, but, for some places, they've got 2-3 weeks of early voting to give people an opportunity to mail in ballots or actually go and vote. In New Orleans, they have this. You can actually go and vote in person weeks before an election. So New York is behind the times with that. I believe we're number 38 in all of the 50 states. And so our perception is in direct contrast with the reality of what it is.
I'm talking with Russell Berman. He's a writer for The Atlantic, and Dr. Christina Greer, professor at Fordham University. And Christina, I think we're talking local, and we're obviously talking local, but we have to acknowledge that we had this huge presidential election, and it had an impact on how people feel about politics and feel about being engaged in the process. Voter suppression was a big issue, and you said that the Trump administration is assaulting the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Do you think what's happened on the federal level with the presidential election has trickled down and affected local elections and the electing of local candidates of color and women?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I think it's galvanized some people. I mean, we're seeing record numbers of women running for office just
That's
because
true.
People feel mm-hmm. like we have a sexual predator in the Oval Office, and so we need to do something about it because clearly Washington, Republicans in Washington are just co-signing the president's agenda, and that's making a lot of people feel very mm-hmm. uncomfortable. Part of that quote was in the context of, you know, this administration for me is an assault on the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Immigration Act. Those three acts should be taken as a triumvirate of acts, and so the systematic dismantling of the three of those, you dismantle one, you're ostensibly trying to dismantle all of them. I think the other huge piece that's most concerning to me on local, state, and national level is the how we're going to conduct our census in 2020, just because the ramifications that we'll have on a local level for our resources,
right.
for how we elect our candidates, for how we redraw districts, will really be felt by people of color. And if we keep a citizenship question on the census, and we know that we have mixed status households, Asians, Blacks, Latinos, and whites, right? And we know that most people will not fill out the census if they feel like it could be used against them. I can't blame them at all, right? I'm a citizen.
Yeah.
I'm highly educated, but I'm thinking about, you know, what are the pros and cons of filling out the census? So we know that that will have real repercussions as to how our local races are conducted and the money that's put into them, and also our communities, especially communities of color, who will disproportionately not fill out the census. So in 2010, mm-hmm. when Queens lost population, which we all know is absolutely
did not
true,
happen.
But we do know no. that Queens has a very large immigrant population, documented and undocumented. So I can't blame the citizens of Queens and the individuals in Queens who did not fill out the census, but we do know that Queens suffers because we're not taking an accurate count. And if we read the Constitution doesn't have a lot that's in there. It's pretty much an outline. But one of the specific things that they do say is that we are to conduct a census of our population every 10 years, and not just what kind of people and sort of these
certain people every 10 years.
Yeah, these partisan questions yeah. that are being slipped in there. You know, this administration wants to know, like, what kind of white you are. You know, like, how long yeah. have you been white? Let me decide.
Well, that will be very interesting to see how that census ends up affecting the conversation we're having
yeah,
today.
Yeah, and I do think it'll affect mayors yeah. in a lot of ways because of the resources that they will and will not get.
You've given us a lot to think about. Everyone should go read Russell's article. I'm Allison Stewart, and I've been speaking with Dr. Christina Greer, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University, and Russell Berman, staff writer for The Atlantic, whose recent story is The White Man's Club Leading America's Largest Cities. Thanks so much to both of you for joining
Thank
us.
You.
This was a really
Thank
good
you.
Conversation.